Hi, everyone. Welcome to our fourth episode, part two of Lemonology, the knowledge sharing platform. My name is Grant Pringle. I'm an SEO growth specialist at Pill Lemon Agency. And once again, we've got Cameron, who is our head of SEO audits. Welcome to the second part of our podcast, Cameron.
Thank you, Grant, and thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be sharing some of the knowledge bombs that I have got in my experience, and I'm eager to learn from you and from the audiences as well, if they will in the comments.
Well, you know, as I said, you know, this is why knowledge is power, as the saying goes. And when it comes to SEO, there's so many things to learn. You know, post our previous discussion, we obviously delved into a few aspects around technical SEO, but there's just been so much to chat about. And I think in today's episode, we're going to basically dive into the remaining part of our questions. And the first part of the questions with relating to technical SEO is the most important thing is, what are the best practices for optimizing images for SEO, Cameron?
Okay, so that's a good question, by the way. So images or multimedia in general, they are very important for on-page optimization and like matching the search intent and then clearly explaining the content of the page. So they are very necessary. So I have kind of some best practices in my mind, and that can help our audiences, that have helped me as well, to kind of optimize my images for SEO and kind of boost our ranking. So these are like the first major thing that I keep in mind. So some are major, small things. I will touch base on all of these.
Perfect.
Things. So the first thing is to use relevant and descriptive file names, because you know, when you click an image, that image is named something like, if it's 21st June or 30th June, it will be named 30th June 2023 and the timestamp as well. So that's normal thing with cameras and mobile phones. They kind of randomly name it, but you okay. do not want to upload an image that's randomly named. You just name it, okay. rename it, use a relevant and descriptive file name. For example, if you are uploading an image of a coffee, name it something like a coffee cup that can that has black coffee in it or something like that, and maybe use your keywords in it. Like if you are optimizing for keywords, why not use it in your file names? So when you are using your file names, another thing to remember is to put hyphens or dash in between different words. For example, if you are naming, for example, the image is best coffee in the world, for example, if that is the image name that you are going to give, so best dash coffee dash in dash the dash world. So that's how you name it. And then another thing to remember before you even start optimizing images is to use original images. Original images always works. They can even help you in link building as well, by the way, because if you have kind of used images or you kind of have some images that you have created yourself with your camera or mobile phone, and they are really great images, and some other people will also use it. For example, if you have uploaded it to image sharing websites, if they use it, you can actually reach out to them to get you a link as well, because they have used your image for free. They can just at least give you credit as well for that. So using original unique images is the way to go. And then using relevant and descriptive file names is the second thing to do. And then another thing is related to the usability and the speed factor. Because when you capture an image with a camera or you download an image from image sharing websites, the image size is most of the time very large. And the format is also not according to... it's not most of the time customized to your theme, because the WordPress theme and the blog structure that you are using, you will have to format it accordingly. You will have to resize it accordingly. There are tools for resizing images. There are free tools and plugins for resizing images as well. We will share the links in the description for those as well. Then there comes the fourth thing is adding alternative text, which we call alt text, A-L-T text. So alt text is usually, I mean, we already discussed this in our previous podcast as well, episode one, that alt text are alternative text. They are normally for used for to describe an image. Like, for example, if the image has not been loaded, like the internet connection is not strong, or there is some problem with your page, then user can get an idea of the image by just reading the alt text. Like, for example, if a motorcycle is a Yamaha motorcycle is standing beneath a green tree, you can just explain it in the alt text. Plus, it helps the visually impaired people as well to know what's in the image. So it's an accessibility factor as well. Then,
and you also get audio. You also get audio, if I'm not mistaken, hey Cameron. So besides it stipulating, let's say a red motorcycle or whatever the case is, whatever image is potentially showing, you can get an audio embedded into that alt. So especially for people who are impaired, you can't hear. Is that something that's possible for people to listen to instead of seeing?
I have not kind of tried this strategy yet. So I'm interested to try this out. I'm hearing this, it's unique thing that you mentioned. We can try this out, but personally, I haven't tried. So that's why I'm not included in my best practices yet. When I have tried this, and if I feel it works, we will always include this in our best practices for optimizing images. Again, we can always edit or add in description or something like that. So, and then you can, when you are using a CMS, a content management system like WordPress, they give you an option to use captions to images and image titles as well. You can utilize those areas to further describe your image and to further include your keywords within that. So it's another strategy to kind of optimize your image for SEO as well. And then the file structure is also important, because just like I when you use the name, relevant and descriptive file name, and it's separated by hyphens, like the different words are separated by hyphens or dash, then it's most of the time the file structure is same. It's great. For example, when you upload an image, it's uploaded to a separate URL, like abc.com/wp-upload, I guess, wp-upload. If it's in WordPress / the image name. So the structure,
and that's on the CMS, right? Uploading it into the CMS at the back end.
So then you also implement image XML sitemaps as well, like including images in your sitemap is also another great way to help Google crawl and discover your images. And then you can also, if you are going a little bit more advanced, use structured data to mark up your image as well. That will help Google understand what's the image about. And then one of the most important factor, apart from the ones that we have mentioned, is the image placement, actually. It's because the place where you are placing the image within the content and what is the surrounding content, it also matters. So if you are placing an image it in an irrelevant place, it cannot be that much helpful for your ranking purposes or for user experience purposes as well, as compared to when you place it in the right place with the right surrounding content, so that Google can understand the context of the image. And using responsive images and mobile friendly images is another way to optimize images for SEO as well. And then just like we discussed, including in XML sitemaps and including those sitemaps in robots.txt so that Google can actually access it. It's also important for SEO purposes as well. So I guess that summarizes my best practices for image SEOs.
That's fantastic. That's a really great breakdown, Cameron. And you've definitely hit the nail on the head. There's just so much more. When it comes to images, it's an integral part of, you know, from a visualization perspective. And especially nowadays, a lot of people, including infographics, because it obviously stipulates a more a visual understanding of a certain topic. And, you know, most of these files are relatively large, but it depends on how you can optimize these pages specifically. And by having the correct files, the correct alt descriptions, and like you said, and customizing it to mobile and desktop, so that way it can be more efficient for a user to actually see an image and understand what the image is about. should it not even upload? Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
So just moving on to, we obviously touched base on this in our previous episode, but with regards to meta tags, title tags, and meta descriptions, what are the impacts of SEO rankings when it comes to these three fundamentals? Can you just enlighten us an understanding of what part they play with SEO rankings?
So just a word of caution before we discuss this. So these podcasts mostly around our technical SEO, but we discuss the technical SEO and the fine line between technical SEO, on-page SEO, content SEO, and how they are debated in between. At the end, ranking matters. If you call it technical or on-page, it doesn't matter. You just optimize and rank it. That's what matters. And make money, that's what matters. Like make leads, that's what matters. So if anyone is feeling like we are discussing meta tags in the technical SEO podcast, that was the answer for them. Like if they feel it's not a part of technical SEO, it's not necessary for technical SEO, they are perfectly fine. Go right as well. It's a debatable topic. So why not we just focus on ranking it rather than ranking or content, rather than discussing what's technical and what's not technical. So now let's come to your answers. That I guess surrounded around how are the meta tags help us in SEO ranking. I guess that was the question. So
well, you got meta tags and title tags and meta description. So maybe just kick off with meta tags to give us a brief understanding.
Yeah. So meta tags are generally like it includes title tags and meta description. So meta tags are called. So it's a broader name for all of the tags that we are using. So title tags and meta description, they are in the meta tags category. So I would say, and maybe it's a little bit controversial, but I would say indeed they are strong on-page signals, but I personally feel they do not directly impact search rankings, but they do indirectly. It's because they significantly influence the CTR, that's what we call click-through rates and user engagement. If they can significantly influence that rate, like CTR rate, the amount of clicks that you are getting and the amount of user engagement they are getting, they indirectly help you in ranking as well. So that's how it impacts SEO ranking. So title tag is the title that you have, and the meta description is what appears in Google when you search for something. I hope everyone knows that. So so both of them are called meta tags, by the way. So now, optimizing these two, specifically title tags and meta description. Now, nowadays, Google can also choose a tag and description of their own. So we can just influence them. We can tell them that's our ideal meta title tag and description, but it's up to Google to honor our request or not. But equally, they're important as well. So now when you have the right title tag and right meta description used, like including this matching, that's matching the search engine. For example, if someone is searching for best coffee grinders, let's say, and you have the title that's named Best Coffee Grinders in June 2023, and then you have a title, that's the title tag, and then you have a description that also surrounds around this topic in general as well, specifically as well. So that can impact the user's behavior with your page. They will be influenced. Like most of the time, we as humans get attracted to catchy titles and catchy meta descriptions. Nowadays, we use a lot of AI tools to make our titles and descriptions more attractive to click. So it can help you improve your CTR, like click-through rate. And then once it's improved, it also help you improve your user engagement, and it can also land you in rich snippets as well, by the way. For example, if your meta description and meta tags are in the right, like targeting it's hitting the nail, or it's like very focused, very, very focused, and it can be actually a rich snippet as well, like a feature snippet of Of course, it depends on what's the inner content of the page and what's the first paragraph and other paragraphs. But still, it can be is for my knowledge, it can be a contributing factor for the rich snippets as well. So it can in that way it can indirectly impact or ranking or SEO ranking. So that's what I personally feel about the meta tags.
And for keywords, Cameron, so obviously we obviously spoke about the indirect influence that title tags and meta descriptions play. But from a keyword optimization perspective, including those relevant keywords in your descriptions and title tags, I think that's definitely something that influences, that obviously helps with the rankings as well from a search intent perspective.
Yes, obviously, including the right keyword. So the question was around like how they impact SEO rankings. If you were spending the question to how to optimize it, and that's a separate question, by the way.
That's a separate question as well. Yes, yeah. Definitely. No, that's a really good way of understanding it. And then obviously moving on to structured data, this is something we also touched base on our previous episode. In our previous part episode. What is the role of structured data in SEO, Cameron, and how can it actually enhance search engine results?
So just like I guess we mentioned in a previous podcast as well, I call it like spoon feeding Google our search engines.
Yes.
Although they are very, very advanced in understanding what's written in the content in the context of it, still it's becoming more important with the SGE, search generative experience, like marking up your content. It can play a significant role in SEO. It can provide additional context, and it can provide additional information about the web page and its content to search engines. So the best part about it is it uses a standardized format. There are standardized formats where we can use like templates kind of things we can use to mark up different data on our web pages. Like this is okay. That thing, this is an image, we are talking about these topics and so far and so far. So that's in that way we are kind of spoon feeding Google and making helping them understand our content better. So it can impact our search engine results in different aspects. Like it can just like we are talking now with the SGE, the new search engine. It can when you ask it like what's if you have seen that Google event where they actually showed it, when they asked it a question from that AI, it generated the answer from the content, from the top ranking content. So if Google is able to read that,
If
Google is able to read the content properly, if you have marked up it right, then it can be, your content will be more easily crawlable by Google and other search engines, and it can be better presented to users. So it in that way, it enhances search results. And using different tags and different markups and schema, like this is the meta title, that is the meta description, that is another entity, this is the publisher, I'm this publisher, I'm this organization, and my other online presence can be found here and there. So interlinking different things, it can improve the click-through rate as well, just like we talked earlier. And then it can impact the knowledge graph and knowledge panel as well. Like we have actually tested this thing. Like if you are using same as schema, like it's also structured data. If you're using same as schema for your homepage, like for a local business, like they have a local business, when you search for it, they have a kind of knowledge panel or a knowledge graph on the right side most of the time, which shows the business name, the location, the reviews, correct, and all those areas it have got. So we tested it, like, so that knowledge graph or knowledge panel should show the social media pages of your organization as well. In one case, it was not showing it. So what we did is we just implemented the same a schema on the home page in different pages, and it helped us and helped Google understand that this social media page belonged to this organization. So they included it within that area as well. So it's another way to improve your knowledge graph and knowledge panels. us. The two most important things of today are the voice search optimization and localization and personalization. Like local SEO, we already talked about it, but the voice search optimization, like we are increasingly like implementing and using voice search in our daily life. Like, do this for me, call this person, please search nearest pizza near me, something like that. We are giving orders to our smartphones and to different devices like Alexa. So that, if you have the right content rightly marked up using the standardized format to mark up data on web pages, you can have greater chances to be on the voice search results. So that's another aspect of it as well. So, and these different ways, it helps impact our
Definitely.
SEO and enhance it.
Okay. And when we obviously touched on knowledge panels, I think another important aspect is interlinking your social accounts, starting off with, getting all your respective accounts interlinked with your homepage, with your website. And I think those are one of the things that definitely play a important part to structured data, where Google actually in the you obviously got the knowledge panel and the knowledge graph, but behind the scenes is what we call the knowledge graph. Right, Cameron. So that's obviously picking
Yes.
up on the structured data and how the interconnection is actually across, how it actually syncs in with your website, because your website is the main authority of your brand, of your business brand or your personal brand. And I think if you can get your structured data right, your schema markup right, your interlinking right, then you have a win-win
Course.
situation.
Yes.
Obviously, some of our clients, we've been working on some knowledge panels, and we've obviously seen the amount of growth, how fast Google can actually trigger their knowledge panels. And by actually implementing and doing the correct interlinking, it definitely contributes to that. So another important aspect is site links, because you've got your home, about, contact us, or media events, whatever specific pages you want. It's really good to showcase those on the SERP results on Google. So another important aspect is schema markup, like we touched on. And I think that if you can get all your respective primary pages showcased on Google, it will be a great way to establish some authority on your website.
That site links are those the real estate or the search engine SERP state that you got, the digital real estate. For example, it's a war between me and my competitor to occupy the most space on first page.
On
So
first page, yes.
if you have got more area, if you occupied more area, you will be in a better position to be clicked more. So these
Got you.
things depend on website structure and architecture as well.
Okay.
So if you have is the schema, maybe it contribute, but I have not tested it. But most of it is dependent on having the right website structure, architecture, and then having XML sitemaps and making it easy for Google or other crawlers to crawl your website. That way they can say, okay, this is the home page. It has different links to different categories. So it's and then the site links as well. So the schema can also help in that as well. But website structure and architecture is the most important thing we have got. Plus, there is a common myth between different SEOs. I have seen that in different SEO group. It's if these are possible for only large websites. I have managed it for small websites as well, pretty small website as well. You just have to be using the right website architecture and structure and XML sitemaps in all those areas, like using the footer navigation properly, in the upper navigation properly, and that's all it takes, and a little bit of content, a little bit of some kind of little bit of
Okay.
authority, I would say. But, yeah.
Interesting. So, and then also looking at, we all got the numbers, right? There's a lot of numbers that comes to part of SEO. You got your 404s, your 301s and 302s, but mostly specifically, we all know the 404s are the redirectories where your page, your kind of link is broken. But how can the use of redirects such as 301s and 302s be optimized for SEO purposes? Because I don't think we really touched on the 301s and 302s.
So redirects in particular, they are important for kind of a smooth user experience, and they can help you preserve your search engine rankings as well. So for example, in some of the cases, we have got two different pages, but they are targeting the same keyword. Like, it's kind of internal competition between two pages. So in that case, we can use, so there is this canonical tag as well. Plus, we can use 301 redirects or 302 redirects. We will talk about these in a little while. So you can use them to like tell Google that, okay, just focus on that one, just like we use canonical tags as well.
Got you. Okay.
Yes. In that way, it will help us maintain a smooth user experience and preserve our search engine rankings so that we are not competing with ourselves. So 301 redirects in particular, they are the redirects for permanent redirects. Like, they are to be used for permanent changes, I would say. So it helps you preserve SEO value. For example, just like I mentioned, it's a permanent redirect. So it indicates that a certain page or URL is permanently moved to a new location. For example, from location A to location B. For example, if it was site.com/ABC, and if you have moved it to something else like site.com/XYZ, you can indicate it via redirect. So when someone comes to site.com/ABC, they will be automatically redirected by the browser to site.com/XYZ because you have used it permanent 301 redirect. So it should be used when you have kind of permanently moved content from one URL to another. It's mostly used when you have combined the content of two different pages because they were, in a sense, talking about the same things. It's one use case. Just we can have different use cases for it as well. And then it helps us preserve SEO value, SEO rankings, because it transfers the SEO value, if I can use that terminology. SEO value for me, for like link equity and rankings, I would say. For example, if the links it that page site.com/ABC had got some links and some rankings as well, if you permanently redirected to site.com/XYZ, like another page from the old URL to the new one, it can help you transfer that link equity and rankings to that other page as well, to the new page as well. By the way, most of the terminology that we use, it's commonly used terminologies, because as far as I know, maybe they have now, but as far as I know, they are no university degrees in SEO. So we are using some terminologies that are commonly used. So they are just word of mouth, I would say. And then there is no standard. We already discussed that in our start of podcast A as well, like the part first as well. And then if you have done that, once you have redirected, then it's important for you to update all your internal links as well. For example, if that one page is converted to permanently redirected to another page, then it's best for you to update the internal links as well, because it will create a redirect chain. A redirect chain is like one, you are clicking on one URL internal link, it's moving to another. So it's kind of creating a chain. It's not a perfect example of a smooth user experience and a smooth search engine as a crawler experience as well. And then if you have kind of some external backlinks as well, why not inform them that content that you have linked out to is now changed to another content. Just reach out to them. It's
another URL. New URL. Okay.
Yes. Just tell them and they'll update it most of the time. And then you will have to update the XML sitemaps as well for 301 redirects. It's a common problem that we see. It's not that much of a bigger problem, but still it's a best practice to do as far as I have tested it. And then there comes 302 redirects. So 302 redirects is kind of another name for temporary redirects. So it should be used with kind of caution, because it's a temporary redirect and it indicates that a web page or a URL has moved to another location or to a different location, but for a temporary certain amount of time. Like it's a temporary thing, not a permanent thing. So it should be used very wisely and rarely, and only when you genuinely intend to keep the redirection temporary, because search engines may not transfer the SEO value to the new URL because you have used a temporary redirect. So that, okay, that thing should be kept in mind.
So you would resort back to the original URL, but for some reason people just move it over across to a temporary URL until it becomes more prominent to what it was. So, got you.
So identifying when to use 301 and when to use 302 in order to avoid confusing search engines and harming SEO, it's a very important thing when you are starting on this practice. So always take help. If you are unsure, you can reach out to us as well, to Perlemon. We can all obviously help you on that as well. So but using the correct search redirect, it helps with the SEO as well. And then general best practices I just want to quickly mention is general best practice is to minimize the redirect chains. Like use minimum redirect chains, just like we discussed earlier as well. We discussed some tips to avoid those as well. And then using server side redirects are also helpful, using server side configuration like HTXs. But of course, because they are generally faster and more efficient than JavaScript or MetaTag based redirects. Of course, these are some technical discussion, and you will need developers' help for that. If you don't have any developer, need some help, you can reach out to us. And then it's a general best practice to test and monitor your redirects and see if they're working. And then always remember that excessive and unnecessary redirects can negatively impact SEO as well. So use them with caution and
with caution.
Take expert help when needed. Yes.
Yeah.
Take expert help when needed.
Perfect. And then in terms of getting on the link side of things, you've got broken links as well. So what are the actual implications of broken links and how can they be fixed?
Yeah, I guess you also mentioned the 404 error in the previous question as well.
Correct.
I forgot to touch base. So we will just mention this in here because this is the right place for it, maybe the right question for it. So broken links, also known as dead links, are 404 errors. They are like when you land on a page and it's that page or resource no longer exists. So it can have several implications for your website and SEO. Like it is a common negative user experience because a user is searching for something, they landed on a dead page, there are no content within it, and it can decrease your engagement and conversion as well. So that thing should be kept in mind. And then it also has that SEO impact, because when you have a negative user experience, when you have a decreased engagement and conversion, it can impact your SEO as well. User will be bouncing back and Google will be kind of noting this thing down. And then when you have kind of links for that page as well, for if the page is now broken, it's quite possible that the external websites who have linked out to you, external websites which have linked out to you, they can now remove those links. So this is you can be actually losing some external links as well. So all of these contribute to a negative impression on your SEO. And then we should be fixing these things. So how are we going to fix this? It's just very, very simple. It's just identify broken links. You can take help from Google Search Console, but most importantly, use third-party tools such as Ahrefs or the free. Ahrefs is also a free version, and then Screaming Frog also is a free version for smaller websites. So you can audit your website with those.
I think Screaming Frog, you can crawl up to 500 pages, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, 500 URLs.
Okay.
So those can help you identify broken links, and then you just update those broken links. Like if the page is existing, you just make it live, or if it is moved to some other area, you just use a 301 or 302 redirect, just like we discussed, but use with caution.
Yes.
And then another best practice is to have customized for error page as well. We have seen some examples of best 404 pages, like there was some funny 404 error pages as well. Like they had one of the company had placed their developers on the, like photos of developers on their 404 pages, and they were saying like, yeah, that person is responsible for this. Please reach out to them or something like that. That this page is dead or something like that. So you can be can be very creative with the customizing.
Very creative, yeah.
It can be done. We can share some examples with you, or we can actually engage our design team to actually design it for you as well. And then fixing internal links is also important, because if it's a 404 or a dead page, now you need to update your internal link pointing out to that dead page. And then fixing external links, it's also very, very important. Very and then just like we mentioned, reach out to them and tell them it's no longer, the content is now moved out to some other place. Please update your link to maintain the link equity that you have got. And then regularly audit your website. It's a best practice. And regularly keep an eye on your website using Ahrefs Webmaster Tool, Google Search Console, Google Analytics, Google Tags Manager. You can use plenty of tools to keep an eye on your website. So this is a pretty simple example of fixing 404 errors with your website. So I guess this sums up your question, if I'm right.
Well, I think you've answered it in so much detail, and I think that will really give our audience a really good breakdown on how to go about managing their 404 broken links. So, Cameron, just moving on to website security, a very important component is the HTTPS and website security. So how does the HTTPS and website security influence SEO rankings?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in general, website security is a ranking signal. That should be kept in mind. It's a very, very important ranking signal. If we have, of course, seen some websites which are still ranking, but they do not have HTTPS enabled. But maybe it's a temporary matter, and their SSL certificate has expired, and they will be renewing it. Other than that, 90 to 95% of the websites I have seen, they use HTTPS across the website. So it's a ranking signal.
Did you mention SSL certificate earlier?
Yes. Yes, yes. Because these are interlinked together.
Okay.
Because
that's obviously the secured secret socket layer, right? That's basically what Mark Shuttleworth actually founded from Thought.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes. It when it's implemented across the whole website, including images, including every aspect of it, then that is considered a best practice, and then only then security is kind of considered that okay, it's a secure website now, at least apparently with the SSL certificate enabled, and it increases trust in user confidence as well, because when they see a lock on their homepage, a padlock on their homepage, and their browser URL bar, then it's of course improve user confidence and improves user trust with your website as well. Plus, it helps you avoid browsers warnings and penalties as well. Because when you land on a website that's not secured, they will give you a warning that it's not secured. You
it's
still
not
want
secure,
to proceed, and you have to click on the advanced button. And then only proceed.
Correct.
With that. So that warning you need to avoid is such an important factor, that security feature. Yeah. And for correct implementation of HTTPS, you need to enable SSL across your website. For that purpose, on WordPress, we use really simple SSL plugin, which helps us implement that whole thing across the whole website, including the images as well. Plus, it's apart from boosting the user's confidence and trust, it's important factor for data privacy and confidentiality as well, giving the rise of information and the use of World Wide Web. Data privacy and confidentiality has become a very important factor. I just paid to a website, like I just paid to book an appointment to a website, and that website was secure. So I was I had the trust to give my credit card information to them. But if it was not secure, I wouldn't have paid to them. It was, exactly. By the way, some €169 that I paid. Yes.
Yeah.
So it's important, very important. And then ultimately, it improves your users' experience, and you need to implement the HTTPS across your entire websites.
Exactly.
And that is by implementing an SSL certificate, we're pairing it, okay, and implementing it across the whole website. So it in these ways, it improves your SEO and it affects your SEO as well. Plus, yeah, you need to ensure that all the internal links, like including all the images, scripts, and resources, they are using HTTPS URLs, not HTTP. So otherwise, this can give a mixed content error as well, like mixed equality content error as well. If some are HTTP, yeah, some are HTTP, you need to install and implement the SSL certificate across your website. So okay, then the canonical tags that you are using on your website and the XML sitemaps, they need to be referencing to the correct HTTPS URLs as well. So that's another important factor. You
very
need to
important
be using HTTPS URLs across all resources on your website. And then you need to reference them correctly, like the HTTPS URLs version on your XML sitemaps. And then the canonical tags should be using the HTTPS version as well. And then you should be monitoring your website for security vulnerabilities and promptly addressing any issues, because these are the things that need to be taken care of. So of course there are plugins for that as well. Plus the Search Console it can be used as well for identifying any security issues with your website. And then you should be, like, we have frequently seen examples of problems with plugins or some softwares like patches or something like that, or problem with WordPress or other CMSs. So you need to be regularly updating your plugins, make sure to just regularly update and patch your website software and plugins and CMS like the WordPress to minimize security risks that you might be facing. You should be implementing strong passwords as well, and then across
important
your websites.
Yeah.
And then the login page as well. Login page, it's a best practice to, we are just touching bases on some other best practices for your own good as well. In case you are wondering, right, like, why are we discussing that these things as well? What I do is there's a plugin that changes the login URL. You can, like, normally people have site.com/wp/admin or wp/login is a login page, and hackers know this. So you need to have a custom login page, and you can use, if you're using WordPress, you can use plugins to do that for that as well. And ensure to use this thing is real pain when you don't have regular backups. Your website can go down and something bad can happen as well. Your domain can be expired in meantime, and something could have happened. So always there are free plugins for that as well, just like Updraft Plus. You can use those for regular backups as well. And using web application firewalls and security plugins is also in the best practice to protect against malicious activities and attacks. And another just last advice is to stay informed about the latest security best practices and emerging threats, and stay informed by the if some plugin that you are using is being vulnerable for some attack or something like that. So just be careful.
That's an important part, especially in today's age where there's so many hackers out there. Then Cameron, moving on to the robots.txt, how could this be actually used in SEO, and what is the significance thereof?
Okay, robots.txt and sitemaps. We have already discussed the difference in episode 1. If someone is wondering what is the difference between these two, highly suggest you to watch the episode 1.
Definitely.
By the way, it's a general advice. If you're watching the episode 2, please watch episode 1 first, because we are most of the time referencing to that episode as well.
We spoke about the shopping mall, right? The shopping mall, when you walk into the shopping mall and you've got all the maps, all the locations, all the shops, it's a kind of a similar thing. So, please do watch episode 1. That will relate to more further for you.
Yes, so it's like
Elaborate.
you have got a security gate, and then when you enter the shopping mall, there is a map of different shops on different floors. So the security gate is kind of robots.txt. If you are allowed, it means robots.txt is allowed, like you are a crawler. Now, when you are entered on the security gate, now the next thing you need to know is where is this map. So when you find the map, XML site map or HTML site map, you just use that to crawl different areas of the page.
With
So
you.
it's the difference between robots.txt. So robot.txt is a text file, by the way, just like it the name mentioned as well. It's placed in the root directory of a website. It's used to communicate to search engine crawlers. We are communicating actual instructions to them. Like it plays a very significant role in SEO. It guides search engines on how to crawl and kind of index websites content. If at least it does not guide, it can be kind of it can block or either allow them to crawl. So some of the significant ways or some of the important ways it can be used is for better SEO is to control the crawl access, like which crawler do you want to give access to. Like you can block Ahrefs bot, Semrush bots, Moz bots within your robots.txt if you do not want your competitors to spy on you, because these tools can actually tell your competitors that these are the keywords that they are looking for. They have got these links. So if you don't want them to kind of crawl you can block them via robots.txt. And then you can, if you have some sensitive content, you can protect your sensitive content like login pages, checkout pages, or anything like that, or private content. You can protect those by disallowing them from your robots.txt file. And then you can actually, just like we mentioned, direct search engines to crawl what to crawl and what not to crawl.
And
And
what not to
this
call,
way, it improves your crawl efficiency. Like if it's a large website, you do not want to waste crawl budget on unimportant pages. So crawl budget is in another topic. So I will just give you a brief a touch base on that. So Google is a private company, I suppose, as far as I know. Let's just say it like this. Google is a prop exists for to make profits. They are limited on resources, just like any other company. They do not have unlimited resources. So they would want to allocate certain amount of their resources to each website. So you need to make wise use of those resources. And that's only possible when you help them identify what to crawl and what not to crawl, so
But
that
not to
you're
crawl.
using those resources wisely. And then it can help you prevent duplicate content as well. If you disallow, if duplicate content is sometimes necessary to be to stay on the website, apart from the other methods that we have discussed, you can actually block it from robots.txt as well. So these are some of the important significant factors. Just very kind of easy to place a robots.txt file and create one. Just use some online tool, and then if you're using RankMath plugin or Yoast SEO plugin or
Or
all-in-one SEO,
Yoast, yeah.
you can actually use them to create a robots.txt file for you, and it will be placed in the root directory of your website. And then you can specify which directories, subdomains, or specific URLs you want to allow or disallow search engines from crawling. So you can just mention it there. And then just be cautious when using disallowed directories because you can accidentally be blocking important pages or sections of your website.
Of
So
your website,
be
yeah.
very careful about
You don't
that.
want to
Take
obviously block
expert
those
help.
ones, yeah.
Take expert help for that, just like 12 lemons. So regularly review and update your robots.txt file as needed, specifically when making significant changes to your website structure or content. So these are some of the important tips and kind of tricks that I had for robots.txt that I personally use most of the time.
Awesome, Cameron. And then moving on to the last three parts of our episode or questions. So the basically looking at header tags. We did also touch briefly on this in our first episode, but your H1s, H2s, H3s. I mean, what are the what? How can we actually use header tags to contribute to SEO optimization?
So they can, the heading tags can be used to organize the content structure. When the content structure is organized, like you have the proper structure, it improves readability and user experience. When it's when these two things are improved, it can help users to stay a while, stay more, stay longer on your page. It can be a ranking factor as well. So you can include your keyword, relevant keywords within the heading tags, because these are the stronger on-page areas, like the heading tags, to actually tell Google and other search engines like what the page
and
is
your
about.
And your H1 being primary, right? That's the key topic of of your actual page.
So H1 is like the title. Think of it like a book. So H1 is like your title of the book, and then H2 is a different chapters. And within those different chapters, you have different subheadings like H3s or H4s and different contents. So it can help you be featured on feature snippets and on rich results as well. So you will be occupying more digital space. And plus, we people are increasingly using screen readers. So it will be helpful for them as well if you have a proper structure. And it's a best practice for accessibility as well, by the way. So making your website more accessible. So some general best practices that I have in my mind is to use a single H1 tag per page to indicate the main heading or topic, and then use H2, H3, H4 tags to denote subheadings and sections within the content hierarchy. So that can be just like I mentioned, the example of a book. You should be including relevant keywords naturally within the header tags. But remember to avoid keyword stuffing, like do not excessively use it, because excessive use of everything is bad. We all know that.
Especially it's kind of keywords. Excessive use of keywords is really bad too, because you know you're also bearing in mind using those keywords in your content, so you don't obviously want to overuse them. And I think that's a really important aspect of when it comes to H headings. And also, you don't want really long headings, and don't include ampersands.
Exactly. That's what I was coming to next.
Yes.
So I was coming to that point to keep your tags, these heading tags, font size, descriptive, and or reflective of the content beneath them. It's very, very important. Sometimes we forgot that we first give a heading, and then or maybe forgot about what's beneath the heading. So it should be talking about, the heading should be concise, descriptive, and should be talking about what's beneath the content. Like it should be relevant to that content. And then ensure that visual styling of header tags, like font sizing, formatting, aligned with the importance of the content section. So sometimes if you are quoting someone, you can use italic font, italic styling or something like that, different fonts and font size, and like you know that those things matters as well. You should be careful about the styling of the header tags as well.
Of the
you
header
can
tags.
Use of course expert help for that as well, like CSS, using CSS and styling for styling purposes. So these are the important factors that I had in my mind for this.
Brilliant. And Cameron, what are some of the best practices for optimizing? We also touched on internal linking, which is an integral part, you know, to your various other website pages in your website. What are the best practices for optimizing internal linking on a website?
That's a good question. So internal linking, it creates a logical structure. It helps you create a logical strike structure. If one of the page is mentioning some term that you have explained somewhere else, help Google and users, help search engines and users find their place by actually linking out to that place on your content. It creates a logical structure. Plus, in other respects, just like we mentioned previously as well, is to the heading tags and the footer tags. If you are using that right, those are also internal linking. So that also helps you create a logical stripe structure as well, because they are existing on every page and these are internally linked. So another important factor is to use descriptive anchor text. You should not be using read more, click here, or something like that, generic anchor text. And then link placement is very important. You should be optimizing that, like where you want to place your link. It's very, very important, the surrounding content around it. Google actually consider those as well. You should be naturally using the, like embedding the internal link. Should not be kind of just using it for the sake of using it, for the sake of optimizing your page for it. Why not just include, write naturally, and then include natural links where it is needed.
Yeah.
So you should be prioritizing relevant and contextual links. Like, context matters a lot, and you should be using a consistent linking structure. Like if you're linking to, for example, if your hub page is linking out to sub hub pages, and user linking out in terms to different other pages, so the linking structure should be consistent. Plus the URL structure, we talked about it in the episode first as well, it should be consistent as well, like site.com/best-coffee-in-the-world. Like, this is the best practice, like using your focus keyword in the URL structure, and that's another topic, by the way, as well. And then leverage the proper use of navigation menus and footer links, just like we discussed. Do not use like generic kind of links, like click here, blog page, or something like that. Blog page is okay, home page is also okay, but it's best to, instead of the home page name, use the brand name. Like, if your brand name is Perlemon, why not, instead of home page, you can rename it Perlemon or something like that. So branded anchor text is also plays a very important role in optimization as well.
Okay.
And then breadcrumb navigation, it's also necessary to implement them. If you know about this, do you know about breadcrumb links, by the way, navigation?
No. Can you enlighten us?
Okay. Why not I share my screen with you? So it's like, maybe let me give you an example, because it's better.
I can share. You're welcome to share the screen.
Yeah. So I'm sharing my screen.
Okay.
Okay, can you see my screen now? Can you see my screen now?
Not yet.
Okay, if you can share, maybe, by the way, okay, 1 second. I'm sharing it again. Can you see it now?
Now we can see it. We are back in action, folks. Okay.
it has landed me to another page. Okay, you see the DHL global, and then that kind of symbol, and then Express Export Services.
And Export Services, yes, I see that.
Yes, that exactly is a breadcrumb. Like this. Page 1, page 2, page 3. So, for example, if you are in a page 4, it will tell you home page category 1 and the category hub page A, and then you are in this page. Like, the user know where they are in the journey. So that's also an
important factor. It's quite user friendly, hey? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Then
so
that's
also important. So so that should be implemented as well. And then updating and monitoring internal links when needed, also very important. And monitoring and the internal link performance is also very important, using different tags, Google Tag Manager, maybe your third-party tools like Screaming Frogs, Arifs, Free Arifs version, or Sitebulb, or OnCrawl can also help you with that as well.
With you, okay. Sure, Cameron, that's quite enlightening. And then, now, moving on to our final question of this episode. obviously, web analytics data is an integral part of SEO. And one of the things we obviously need to understand is how can the monitoring and analysis of website analytics data help improve SEO efforts? So can you just give us some examples of, you know, the data that can help improve SEO efforts?
It's a very broader question, by the way. SEOs, we in general do this. For example, if we have a website, we use Google Search Console and Google Analytics and Ahrefs most of the time to track my ranking, to track analytics, to user, to track user behavior with my website, and Search Console to, for the performance, impressions, and click-through rates I have got, and links I have got as well. So combining and using the right tools all together can help you understand user behavior, so that you can take informed decisions. And then you can, they can help you identify high performing pages and keywords so that you can further optimize and further optimize. Remember, most of the blog pages that you see that are like 10,000 word large or something like that, they're not created this much in length at first place. So when you have a page that is like 2,000 words in length, Google is ranking it for different keywords, for related keywords. You just re-optimize it, include those in your page as well. And then it's just a process of re-optimization. How is this possible? It was possible because you were tracking your high-performing page and your high-performing keywords in Google Search Console or Ahrefs. So that these can help you track your search engine ranking and further take informed decision as well. And then it can help you refine your content strategy, actually, so that you kind of refine your content and then your strategy
and your keywords. In general,
like what's performing and what's not performing. If what is performing for you, why not scale these things up? And then monitoring site speed and performance also in other important aspects.
Definitely
as a
important.
Part of daily analytics data that we actually monitor. And mobile performance is also another factor that we consider, and or web analytics data. So all of these metrics, you just monitor and kind of track these things to help you take informed decisions. But in general, to help you rank more for more keywords, for more to place your content in front of more users, and in general, kind of take more leads and more money home. Mm.
Brilliant. Jeez. Well, Cameron, that's really a really great overview. But there's so much more to analytics. And like you said, we can always have a discussion around that in further detail or even create another episode around that. But first and foremost, Cameron, I really want to thank you for enlightening us and giving us a really good overview of technical SEO. I think that boils down to all the 20 questions that we have in our part two episodes. And for all of those, be sure to watch our very first episode. You can click on the link below and get more information on that. And I really appreciate your time, Cameron. It's been great having you. And I definitely think we need to work on some subtopics or some H2 topics for the next episodes to come. So we'll definitely bring you in for those to come. But thanks so much.
Obviously.